I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Charles Frazier. He's author of the novel Cold Mountain, which won the National Book Award for Fiction. It was adapted as a movie, and this year it's been transformed into an opera, which premieres at the Santa Fe Opera this Saturday, the 1st of August. He will be speaking tomorrow night at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
This book, I was thinking about it as I was reading this book. I mean, you wrote this book 20 years ago. It's brand new for me. It'll probably be brand new for a lot of people who maybe heard about it or saw the movie but never actually picked up the book at the time that it was written. And I want to talk to you about the opera and about the process of turning a book like this into other media. But if you don't mind, I really want to ask you some things about the book. First of all, I mean, the process of coming to write a novel set in the time of the Civil War, and as I think you've said, I read somewhere that you maybe started out thinking about the Iliad, but it really became the Odyssey, and it's not about battles, except maybe as memories of horror. It's not primarily about slavery. How did this book take shape in your mind and come to be?
Well, I'd never been that interested in the Civil War, that kind of obsessiveness that some Southerners can have about the generals and the battles and movements of troops and all that. But I'd heard this family story that made me drop a book I was working on at the time and start thinking about this ancestor that deserted from the Civil War. And I realized I can get interested in it if it starts at the end. His war is done. He's quit. I'm going home. I'll take the consequences. That once I started seeing it as an Odyssey instead of the Iliad, where the focus was on the damaged warrior trying to get back to home, peace, familiar territory, all of that, relationships that existed before the war, to see what his life is going to be, then I could get excited about working on that book.
How much did you know about this relative?
Almost nothing. My father remembered a family story about this guy who'd been in a lot of really key battles, had been wounded several times, was badly wounded, deserted, and walked home, and was killed by the home guard shortly after he got back. So it was, I could write it all down on a 3x5 card.
Right, right. This book is so powerful for so many reasons, and not only does it have, I'm sure, not that I'm a historical specialist, but it seems to have so many of the details really spot on, but also the feel of the time. I mean, 1860s North Carolina. Did you have to retreat from 20th century life in order to get yourself into that headspace?
To a degree, yeah. A lot of it, I grew up in a fairly isolated part of the Southern Appalachians. And when I was a little kid, my grandparents, who were both born in the in the 19th century, were still running their little farm the way they saw farms run when they were young. So they didn't own a car, they didn't own a truck, there was not an internal combustion engine on the farm. It was all done with horses and human power. So I saw that. Their farm would have been very much like a late 19th century farm, except there was electricity. So I tried to remember those early childhood, just the texture of things, the feel of things, the kinds of tools my grandfather used, those sorts of things to get into that, the detail of that world.
Yeah. The understanding not only of the farm and of the really arduous nature of being able to live off of what you do with your hands, what you produce at the farm, but also the understanding of nature itself really struck me, because, I mean, there's this you know, there are the farms, there's wilderness in which the main character Inman survives as he makes his way home. And there's also, I guess the way I felt it was, it's a view of nature that's not informed by what I think was a kind of later aesthetic, which is the picturesque grandeur of America, and or like what we have now, which is the incredible beauty of nature and sort of National Geographic types of photographs. This is earth and land and creatures and sometimes beauty, but mostly something much more practical and dangerous at the same time. Do you feel like you had to kind of expel that picturesque sense of nature from your mind? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I thought a lot about that very question as I was working about how. For my grandfather was born in either 1879 or 1882, depending on which document you look at. And I tried to think what nature might have meant to him as a boy, that there would have been a lot more threat. There was very little, you know, safety net. You know, the rescue squad was not going to come find you if you got lost in the woods. Just to think about the infrastructure we have that makes nature less threatening, that wasn't there then. So I thought about that kind of thing. I thought about just the dirt and mess of making a living off of a small farm. That it certainly wasn't all beauty and, hey, we've got fresh tomatoes we grew ourselves. You know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing what 100 years can do. I mean, that was a time, and one so feels it in the book, where the land is truly wild. You can get lost, you can get hurt, you can get killed very easily. And now we've sort of paved and cultivated and built to the point where not only is it harder to get lost, it's almost like there's no place to hide.
Yeah. And, you know, in that, in Inman escaping, deserting from the war, and the roads were full of Home Guard looking for deserters then. But no communication, weak communication between groups of them. It would have been much easier to be an outlaw then than now.
Why were there so many deserters?
An awful lot of them. Like my ancestors, there were four brothers who they grew up on a small farm in western North Carolina. They did not own slaves. They didn't have that economic stake in the war. I still don't fully understand why they volunteered to go fight. By that point of the war, it was clear what the conclusion was going to be. And I think a lot of those young men who had been so enthusiastic for various reasons at the beginning kind of didn't want to be the last few to die in that stupid war. So they were leaving in droves from the trenches in Petersburg and elsewhere, and walking home. I can't even count how many times in bookstores people have come up and said, "My great 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 grandfather deserted and walked home," and we have some of his journals or letters or that kind of thing. So it was very common in those last months.
I can see this whole thing of, like, I don't want to be the last guy to die in a war that can't be won. But then there's this question that you were saying a moment ago, you're not even sure why your ancestors signed up. Like, what were people really fighting for? Did they believe in it? I mean, that's what one wonders.
Well, the reason people whose personal economies were tied up with slavery were fighting was certainly slavery. slavery was the root cause of the war, as much as a lot of Southerners have tried to deny that for 150 years. It's a little less clear to me why people who lived away from the slave economy, away from plantations, that part of the South, what they were fighting for. I mean, young men get deluded into enthusiasm for war for all kinds of reasons, but I think there was a sense of the North wanting to conquer the South. And you know, you have to remember that the United States, people in the States didn't quite think of the country in the same way that we think of it now. For a lot of people, the state was the primary unit, not the nation as a whole.
The book is not primarily about slavery, but there is a really harrowing story in it, the story of Odell and the woman he loved, who was a slave woman. Tell us a little bit about this story. Did it have a source in real life?
The story is this this young plantation heir. He was going to inherit the plantation, and fell in love with one of the slaves, and then she was sold away, and he goes on his own odyssey trying to find this woman. And I wrote it just out of imagination, and then started doing research to see if it was possible, and actually found a couple of stories that were very similar to it that actually happened. There was one where the young man who went looking for the sold slave, they married, they had a long life together, had many children. It was really a very beautiful story.
What were some of the sources that you used to really get the details right? I mean, it seems like, I was reading this book, it was like, this man knows everything. It's like 19th century firearms and how they work, and not only how they work, but what they feel like in your hand, you know. Clothing, houses, weather, roads, food. I mean, nature is, it's the category all by itself, but where did you go?
Well, most of the research, I was living outside of Raleigh, North Carolina then, so I had the good libraries at Chapel Hill and Duke to work from. So a lot of it was research there, and I'm an old, you know, old graduate student, so spending time digging through old documents is something I enjoy a lot. I mean, to a degree, I would sometimes have to cut off the research and force myself to get back to the writing,
because
I like the research a lot. But things like 19th century travel writing, you'd get lots of details about things like clothes and road conditions and weather and all that. I had found, I didn't actually use it, I had to quit being that ridiculously obsessive, but I had weather every day for about a 6-week stretch of Inman's journey, and part of me wanted to make his weather actually be the weather that was.
I had, you mean you had a document where somebody described the weather?
Yeah. I had a very primitive, remember this was, you know, 20 years ago, very primitive computer program that you could punch in a date in history and it would show you the sky every hour through the night. And I had all these charts of which constellations, which planets, what moon phase it would have been, and was going to make everything absolutely perfect, and thought, that's just crazy, let that go.
Yeah, but I can see, I mean, yeah, the obsessive urge to do it, but also it somehow makes it more real if you ground it in that way.
Yeah, well, I began to feel like I had kind of internalized all that detail, and that maybe every bit of it didn't need to to find a home in the book.
One thing I noticed about the way the narrative is told that really interested me a lot was that, I mean, a lot of things happen, big things, good and bad, painful and sometimes beautiful, and you never see, or I don't think you see, a person's reaction of grief or joy. It's like a thing happens and there's not a reaction, there's an action. Like a character's father is wounded and you never see her saying, oh my God, woe is me. She gets busy looking for roots.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted pretty much all of these characters to be pretty internal people. And Ada would be the kind of person, if you, you know, if you were working a little more with stereotypes, that would be falling apart at the first thing. But she, you know, she has she's a very internal person, and tends to go toward more melancholy than drama when she reacts to things. And Inman is, you know, is very much a stoic.
Very much a stoic, and I mean, so, ladies and gentlemen, Inman is the one who's coming home from war. Ada is the woman that he's going home to find. And one thing that I thought was really kind of interesting and well done is the way Inman, I mean, there are various times throughout the book where he has to kill somebody in order to survive, or in maybe in one case to help somebody else to survive. And it's not cruel. He doesn't take pleasure in it either. There's a kind of practicality and emotionless to it, and yet he's sorry that he has to do it. It's very subtly and beautifully done. It's something that I've never seen represented, I mean, in certainly 20th and 21st century dramas that have so much violence and killing in them, that in them in our own culture.
Well, I thought of him from early on in developing the character as somebody who kind of like he has a talent for fighting, but it's not something that he's all that interested in or emotionally invested in. When he has to do it, he does it and he's good at it, but it's not something he seeks out. He tries to avoid it when possible, but when he can't avoid it, then he is very good at it.
There's another theme that I found interesting, which is not a main theme of the book, but it's like the ghosts of Indians are there among us, and you feel them, and although you don't, they're gone, you don't get to know actual people. And I wondered if you could kind of comment on that theme and that sensibility of that place, North Carolina.
Well, all of that Cherokee territory that was western North Carolina, east Tennessee, north Georgia, that whole big area that the Cherokees controlled, and all of those people were wiped out, sent to Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears, except for this very small group of Cherokee who were able to stay. And I wrote my second novel, 13 Moons, partly as an attempt to try to understand how they were able to stay. But there was this remnant culture of Cherokee, and I grew up just a few miles from one of the communities. So I wanted, you know, just in trying to tell the story of that place, wanted the Cherokee to be represented.
There's a very poignant passage where one of the characters comments when they take refuge in what had been a Cherokee village, and one of the characters comments on people who had once been there who had names for everything and ways of thinking about the same things that she was looking at that will never be known again, that are just gone.
Yeah, And of course, that's not entirely true in the sense that the Cherokee are working really hard to preserve their language. But from Ada's perspective, she could imagine that all those words to describe everything around her would be lost. And, you know, it's still a struggle to keep them from being lost.
We're talking to Charles Fraser about his book, Cold Mountain. Let's shift gears for a moment and talk about the process of adaptation. Now, this is something that you've now gone through twice. The book, Cold Mountain, was made into a movie. Now it's being made into an opera. If you don't mind, I'd love to hear about what it was like for you when somebody first approached you and said, we'd like to make a film of this. I mean, I was thinking as I was reading this book, and I read some of it, mostly I actually listened to the book on audiobook, and ladies and gentlemen, it's actually Charles Fraser's mellifluous voice reading it, so it was a wonderful experience. But it takes a lot of nerve to take that book and make it into a movie, because so much of what you have in that book is the right, and it's not that the characters aren't great and that there isn't a plot and a drama and all that, there is, but so much of what makes it powerful is the writing and the very kind of slow, detailed pace of the narrative. So you get approached. What happened?
Well, within, maybe a month after Cold Mountain was published, and this was the first novel, I wondered all the way through, you know, is this thing ever going to be published? And then 4 weeks after publication, I'm getting calls from producers and directors wanting to buy the film rights. And so Anthony Minghella was one of the people who called, and we shared a certain amount of sort of history. We had both taught in universities and that kind of thing, And I just liked his approach to the material, his thinking about the material, his very straightforwardness about wanting to do it. So it was, it was a very odd feeling to have gone from, is this thing going to get published, to it being on the bestseller list and, you know, very quickly having a movie sale. And it was several years before he finished the screenplay, started making the movie. We spent a lot of time together. He came to North Carolina several times, and we would go hiking in mountains. We took a long car trip from the mountains to the coast in North Carolina. Saw each other in London and Rome, and had a lot of time to talk about what books do well, what movies do well, what weaknesses there are. And of course, one of the big things is time. A movie, there's a real tyranny to the length of a movie. And he said when he was working on the screenplay, he said, you always have the option, if you sense a problem, of solving it through addition. He said, at some point in a screenplay, that is off the table. It can't become longer. We talked about the way books can move through time. A novel can move through time very fluidly, just back and forth. It's very easy to do. Movies want to move forward. They resist flashbacks, and they always feel kind of hokey even if they're done fairly well. So we had a lot of time to talk about that. Like it was like being in a graduate seminar every time we were together.
It must be so interesting to work closely on your work with somebody who is of equal caliber in a completely different medium, and see how what those different media can do and can't do.
Yeah, it is, and it's very interesting watching the way, given those time constraints and given the things that work well and don't work well in movies and opera, to look at the ways that that Anthony Minghella and Gene Cheer have solved those kinds of problems by conflating scenes. There are a lot of scenes that I look at and I have to stop and think, oh, this bit came from this scene in the book, but then another part of this scene in the movie or the opera. You know, there may be five scenes that are combined in a very interesting way.
Right. And they wouldn't, like, if you're going from the book in a very literal way, it doesn't make any sense, but if you pull back from the book, it has its own sense.
Yeah. There was a scene being filmed in Romania for Cold Mountain, and it was take after take after take. And at some point, Anthony turned around and said, "Charles, this is not a rhetorical question. This scene is in the book, right?" And I said, "I'm not sure." And I really wasn't. And it was because there were bits and pieces. We had to go back that night and reconstruct where that scene came from.
Interesting.
But most of it came from the book, just not the same place in the book.
Romania.
Yeah.
Why not North Carolina?
Oh, I think that all came down to budget.
Yeah. Okay, well, you mentioned Gene Cheer a moment ago, and he is the librettist. Let's start talking about the Santa Fe Opera. I mean, here's this book, best-selling, prize-winning book, Cold Mountain, made into a movie, and then some years later, you were approached to make it into an opera. How did that happen?
Jennifer Higdon had, just within about 2 weeks, had won the Pulitzer, and then I got a call, and she said, basically, I'd like my next big project to be an opera, and I'd like to do Cold Mountain. If you think it's a bad idea, tell me now, and I'll move on. And I said, well, I think it sounds like an interesting idea, and then we talked and have met a number of times over the years. That was 5 years ago, so it seemed like a very an idea so far into the future that I never really expected the reality of it, which is now here this week.
What was your role? I mean, did you have a kind of collaborative, I mean, obviously you're not on set, or that's not set, but on like backstage or whatever with the opera singers, but did you have a collaborative role on this?
Well, Gene came to Asheville, and we spent some time driving around and talking the way Anthony and I had done. And then he spent about a week in Western North Carolina in a little 18th century resort town called Hot Springs, working on the writing. And we've met and talked, and pretty much all I've been is sort of cheerleader, pat on the back, kind of thing over the years.
Now, you and composer Jennifer Higdon are actually from really the same part of the world.
Yeah, grew up maybe as the crow flies 60 miles, something like that. The Smoky Mountain National Park separated the two little towns we grew up in.
What has the process been like of working together, and how do you see her as an artist taking your work into another medium?
Getting to know Jennifer has just been one of the great delights of this past 5 years. I've known a lot of writers, musicians, artists, artistic people, but she just strikes me as the truest artist I think I've ever met, in that her art seems to just flow through her constantly, which may sometimes be hard to live with. I don't have that all the time and envy it, but when it is flowing, it can be tiring. But she is just such an incredible artist, and I admire her in so many ways.
I wanted to ask you this sort of silly question, but do you think your character, Ada, would have been an opera fan?
Oh, I think given her background in Charleston with, and Charleston has the deepest theater history of any city in the United States. I think with her education, the city she grew up in, she certainly would have been.
What about you? Are you an opera kind of dude?
My musical tastes are, I think, really wide. Opera has not been a big part of that until the past couple of years.
I mean, the book Cold Mountain is so, that's another thing that seems really deeply felt, to the point where I wondered if you were a musician yourself.
I am not. I sometimes regret not playing an instrument, but I'm an appreciator rather than a musician.
You've written a couple of novels since Cold Mountain, which are now on my reading list, but I haven't read them yet. What are you working on now?
I'm maybe not quite halfway into a book that's partially based on the life of Verena Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis. A lot of it will be after the Civil War. She was this really smart, really well-educated woman from Mississippi. After her husband died, she packed up, moved to New York City, and lived the rest of her life there, mainly making her living as a writer. And I'm very interested in her sort of the weight of history that she carried with her when she moved to New York. She and Ulysses S. Grant's wife became pretty good friends, and she later said that the right side won that war. So I guess what interests me about her is the price you pay for being wrong about, being on the wrong side of history.
It's funny, I was thinking about Germany and how Germany reacted after World War II, and they were obviously on the wrong side of history, and they then spent, decade after decade doing art and literature dealing with World War II. And dealing with the guilt and pain of what they had inflicted on others. And then I was thinking about our own country and the South and slavery. And, when you look at what's going on right now, there's still a lot of people who aren't sure that the wrong side lost. That the right side won.
Yeah. In writing Cold Mountain, one of the things that I had in my mind from the start was the glorification of that war has always bothered me. And when I was saying that I wasn't interested in the war and the generals, that's a lot of why I wasn't, feeling the falseness of that glorification. So I tried to write a book that looked at the damage of that war. I don't know. I think some of it is just kind of a cult of personality, that some of those Southern generals were so charismatic, so dashing, they're really interesting historical figures. But if you let your thinking of the war be controlled by those strong, interesting personalities, somebody like Jeb Stuart, for example, very flashy guy, then it blinds you to some of the realities of that war.
I've been wondering what, and I'm not a Southerner myself, but I have some very good and deeply wonderful friends who are Southerners and have a kind of an affection for the American South. And I wonder if you have a vision of what Southern culture and society and identity could be without racism. which seems to be so integral for so many people.
Yeah, well, it's race in the South is enormously complicated. Just like slavery itself was not a monolithic institution, the modern sense of race in the South is just, you know, way understanding that is so enormously complicated. It's class based in many, many ways. The South is a lot of different regions, and as you move from one region to another, you feel a difference in race. Things have changed enormously over the past 30, 50 years, for the better, and is continuing to do so. But there's still that entrenched part of the culture that's fading, but fading too slowly.
Would you like to read a passage from Cold Mountain?
Sure. Well, this little bit is from very near the end, and Inman has been shot. He's lying on the ground. Ada finds him, and it's I guess what I was trying to do here was to in a very compressed way let all of the things about nature that the book had been dealing with for 450 pages almost at that point, to let that all rest in Inman's mind for a minute. So Ada comes to where he's there on Cold Mountain, lying on the ground. When she reached the place, the boy had already gathered up the horses and gone. She went to the men on the ground and looked at them, and then she found Inman apart from them. She sat and held him in her lap. He tried to talk, but she hushed him. He drifted in and out and dreamed a bright dream of a home. It had a cold water spring rising out of rock, black dirt fields, old trees. In his dream, the year seemed to be happening all at one time, all the seasons blending together. Apple trees hanging heavy with fruit, but yet unaccountably blossoming. Ice rimming the spring, okra plants blooming yellow and maroon, maple leaves red as October, corn tops tasseling, a stuffed chair pulled up to the glowing parlor hearth, pumpkins shining in the fields, laurels blooming on the hillsides, ditch banks full of orange jewelweed, white blossoms on dogwood, purple on redbud, everything coming around at once. There were white oaks and a great number of crows, or at least the spirits of crows, dancing and singing in the upper limbs. There was something he wanted to say.
Charles Frazier is author of the novel Cold Mountain, which is being transformed into an opera, which premieres this weekend, this Saturday night, at the Santa Fe Opera. I think most of the performances are actually sold out already. I think they've added one more performance.
Yeah, they've added another one.
But ladies and gentlemen, get your tickets quick. Charles Frazier will also be speaking tomorrow night at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.